win the lottery, Paul White can tell you.
I feel this pressure off my shoulders that you carry every day with you. I have two kids. Are my kids, am I going to be able to pay for them to go to college? Am I going to be able to, you know, take care of them if they have health issues? All these things, gone. You don't ever have to worry about it again. It's amazing.
White is a 45-year-old project engineer in Minneapolis. He says his family often kidded with him for playing the lottery. He'll take home a third of the $448 million jackpot. A group of 16 municipal garage workers in New Jersey gets another third of the prize. And one winning ticket is still out there. Powerball officials say it was sold in New Jersey. I'm Paul Brown, and this is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Weinstein Company with Lee Daniels, The Butler, inspired by a true story and starring Forrest Whitaker and Oprah Winfrey, August 16th.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
It's lawn and garden advice time on Focus Today. Hi, I'm Jim Meadows. Horticulture educator Sandy Mason from the University of Illinois Extension is back today to answer your gardening and lawn questions. Good morning, Sandy.
Good morning.
And also on the show today, Leslie Deem. She's an entomologist, study of insects, and the director of the Pollinatarium at the University of Illinois. Welcome to Focus, Leslie.
Oh, thank you.
And Sandy and Leslie are ready to answer your questions about gardening, and in particular with Leslie, attracting the pollinators your plants depend on. She also knows a few things about herbs, I'm finding out. You can call us at 333-9455. That's 333-9455, or toll free at 1-800-222-9455. The number's again 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. Now, the Pollinatarium, it's only about, what, 5 or 6 years old?
About 5 years old. Mm-hmm.
It's open to the public, but first you have to find it. I went out yesterday with only taking a glance at a map, and I failed, but it is relatively easy to get to. It's really on the the south side of the U of I campus in the South Farms area.
Right. It's between Lincoln Avenue and Ray Street and just north of Windsor.
And so there's an entrance off of Windsor. It's a gravel road. There's a sign, but you got to look quick, I understand it.
Yes, and once you turn down the gravel road, there'll be some beehives on your left, and you'll know you're on the right road.
Now, they have regular hours for the public on Saturdays and Sundays?
From 1 to 4. And on Sundays, from June to August, we have a 2 o'clock presentation called Pollination Fascination. So all things about bees and hummingbirds and pollinators and gardening for pollinators.
And so just in general, the Pollinatarium is devoted to the idea of pollination and pollinating insects and other creatures and helping people learn about that. I'm wondering, that's just when it comes to somebody's own garden, and you were talking about the talks you have on the weekends. This Sunday's talk focuses on how pesticides can affect pollinators.
Yeah, how they affect honeybees.
And that's a tricky subject, learning how to attract the bees while getting rid of other insects you don't want. What are some good tips to remember in that area?
I would use as little chemical as possible. The other things are bees are in their hive at night. So if you do any treating, I would do it after dusk or early in the morning before they're out and flying.
Okay, that's good to remember. The talk, what time is that talk going to be at?
2 p.m., and it's Katie Dana will be presenting it. She's a graduate student studying this in the Department of Entomology.
Okay, so that'll be a chance to really get in deep into that issue about protecting your pollinators while you're going after the other insects.
Mm-hmm.
I see a phone call coming in, and let's go ahead and take this phone call on line one. Susan from Urbana, good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. This is for Sandy. I've always planted
some blue salvia, annual blue salvia, in with my perennials, and they make nice additions to bouquets when I bring flowers in, and they color changes nicely as the fall, as the winter, as the cooler weather comes on. But this year, the top leaves are all kind of spindly and not full, and they're not blooming much at all. I've just cut them back to where the leaves look more healthy and put some liquid fertilizer on them. Did I do something intelligent? Can you tell me what's going on?
Yeah, I don't know, because usually, and I'm sure this is probably why you grow them, is that they're pretty tough plants, and usually I haven't really had much complaint at all about the annual blue salvia. It just seems to go on its merry way and doesn't really need a whole lot of anything, pretty drought resistant and all that. So I'm not sure what's going on. I think what you might want to do is actually, whether you want to do that now or maybe a little bit later, actually sacrifice one of the plants and see if there's something going on in the roots. I don't know if you're pretty comfortable with the quality of the seedlings when you got them. You're pretty happy with that. I just wonder if there wasn't something that was going on.
They seemed okay. I always get them at FS, and they seemed fine.
Yeah. So you might check that, you know, things can happen. You might check that, you know, just kind of look at the stem to see if there's anything that might be sort of, you know, whether it's got, because certainly because of the weather we had earlier, you know, it was a little cool there for a while. I'm not sure when you put these in. They're one of those plants that really does like it pretty, you know, fairly warm. They like the warm season and stuff. So I don't know whether they could have, you know, kind of suffered there for a little bit and then not done well. So I'd look at the stem, see if maybe there's any browning or anything on it. It almost sounds like sort of a general kind of stunting that then we'd look at the stem and then certainly the roots. So I would check that too, as certainly as the season progresses and at the end of the season, just sort of, you might want to check that out too. But I think you've done what you need to do as far as just watering, maybe fertilizing, as you mentioned, and see if you can encourage some new growth. But I can't think of any insect and diseases I've really seen too much of anything on the blue salvia.
Yeah, they've been pretty reliable, and they're frost resistant as well.
Yeah, they're great plants. I like them. Actually, once in a while, you get them to reseed a little bit, so I actually kind of like them for that too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Good luck. Yeah.
Thank you, Susan. And Sandy, I was wondering. Susan called in with going to the plant that was showing a particular symptom. We've been talking about pollination. Can a lack of adequate pollination lead to symptoms in a plant or a tree that you will see?
It's probably not so much in the plant itself. It's probably typically when we're looking for the fruit or vegetable, whatever you want to call it, that's when the pollination or lack thereof really shows up. Because for a lot of these plants, you know, they have to have pollinators in order for the fruit to actually develop.
Okay, that's important.
If that is important. If you're waiting for those cucumbers and you don't have any pollinators, then you're going to be waiting a long time.
Okay, so and so if you find that's happening, you're planting something, you're planting some vegetables, especially certain vegetables which may be susceptible to this, and you're not getting any, you're just getting more leaves or whatever. Is that something to explore, that you're not getting pollination?
Absolutely. And we see this a lot probably with things like in the squash family. So, and that's probably the biggest complaint I hear sometimes, that people will say, I'm just not getting any zucchini or cucumbers or whatever it is in that squash kind of viney group. Because all of those actually have male flowers and female flowers.
I was reading about this and thinking, this is awfully graphic for plants.
Too much and early in the morning. So they have to have pollinators. You know, they have to have that cross-pollination in order for the fruit to go ahead and develop. And so if you get nothing but the male flowers, which often happens early in the plant's life, you get a lot of male flowers, and then the female flowers will start to develop, and then you'll need those pollinators later. But so that's probably one of the biggest complaints that I hear is within that group of plants. But also certainly with, and maybe Leslie can even talk about this too, is that if we have a really cool, wet kind of period when apples and pears and stuff are actually...
The fruit trees.
If it's really cool and wet and the pollinators aren't out and about, people will complain that sometimes they just didn't get much. They had flowers, but then no fruit.
Well, Leslie, if you want to attract pollinators, what do you do? I mean, are the things you can do with the plants you have, or is it something about the plants you decide to plant are some of them the ones that the pollinators will really go for?
Well, the pollinators need food from early spring through late fall. So usually I encourage planting something that's going to bloom really early and get your pollinators visiting the area. But you can also plant a lot of plants that will attract them. Right now, some things they're going a lot to are anise hyssop. So different times of the year, there's going to be things that will attract them and give them nectar and feed them much more.
What is it that attracts a pollinator? What do they? And I guess we're talking about more than just bees.
We're talking more than just bees. If we're trying to attract bees, they're going to flowers for two kinds of food. They're going for pollen and nectar. Now, if you want to attract butterflies, they're going to need plants that are for nectaring, and they need plants for laying their eggs on. The caterpillars need leaf material to eat. So, like, if you want swallowtails and you want to feed the caterpillars, you can put in dill, and fennel would be a good one.
That's the tricky thing with butterflies, is that caterpillars will come with them.
Yes. So for gardeners, that like a pretty pristine garden, but you want to help support the butterflies and caterpillars, I would suggest having some stock plants in another part of the garden. So then when this caterpillar eats down your whole little fennel plant, you can just plop in another one to keep it looking pretty, but the caterpillar got to become a butterfly too.
Okay. Can you pretty much... Is it possible to keep the caterpillars over to the stock plants and not go eating the other ones?
We do not usually get to dictate where the butterfly lays its eggs, but something you can do. And people have been doing this. They get caterpillars on their plants at home. They don't have enough extra for them and the caterpillars. We are taking orphan caterpillars, and we have a children's garden where we have plants to put them on so they can eat and become butterflies. So we will accept, we've been accepting swallowtail caterpillars. We haven't seen any monarchs yet this year. Mm-hmm. And we also take tomato hornworms that eat on nicotinia and things.
Should we be seeing monarch butterflies?
I've only seen two monarchs this year, and I haven't seen any caterpillars in our garden yet.
Okay.
So it's been a low year for them.
Yeah, I haven't seen any in my garden either. I've seen two monarchs, and that's it, but no caterpillars yet.
Well, we are on Focus talking about lawn and garden care with Sandy Mason from the U of I Extension, and talking about pollinators, the insects and sometimes other creatures that will pollinate your plants, with Leslie Deem of the Pollinatarium at the U of I in Urbana. Let me go to another call on line one. Dixie from Urbana, good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi. I'd like to know about some growth on mulch. I put fresh mulch under four 10-year-old crab trees earlier this summer. The mulch developed a few circles of white moldy stuff, which I know I don't need to worry about, except one of those circles is around the base of one of the crab trees. The circles that were just out in the rest of the mulch have pretty much dried up, disappeared. But this one under around the tree now actually circles the entire tree, and it has grown up about 3 to 4 inches. I've scratched on it. It seems wet under there, and I'm worried that it's going to damage the tree.
Yeah, most of the, I mean, it's not uncommon to get, especially when you put down fresh mulch, and then we get some cool, you know, even just wet times.
Sure.
You'll get, you know, and it's just growing off of the decomposing mulch. So it's a wood. So typically those are all the ones that actually growing off of dead stuff. They typically are not the ones that are going to be growing on live trees or something that would actually invade live trees. So usually that's not the case. I don't know if this is actually where the mulch is actually touching the trunk. I wouldn't do that anyway. It's always a good idea to sort of keep the mulch away from the trunk.
It was about 3 inches away from the trunk.
Yeah, you might want to just pull it back a little bit just to make sure that there's good air circulation through there, because we don't want to encourage any trunk rot or anything like that. So it's always good to pull the mulch away. And I would say at least probably 6 inches, or, you know, it's really sort of keep it away. But I'm not sure I'd worry too much. Usually if people are having trouble with or concerned about fungi in mulch, usually, as you said, just kind of just fluff it up a little bit, take a rake. Usually that's enough that at least for that moment or so, they sort of, you don't notice them as much. But you will see as that mulch decomposes, you'll often see all kinds of really pretty interesting fungi. Sometimes I've seen some really interesting stuff, like slime molds.
Colors.
Yeah, nice colors sometimes, and very odd shapes sometimes. There's one called the dog vomit fungus, and that's exactly what it looks like. So it's really interesting names.
This is actually on the bark of the tree now, growing, on attached to the tree and up about 3 inches. And I'm wondering if
you might take pictures.
Was there a dead spot on the tree already?
No. These are 10-year-old trees, and they're very healthy.
Yeah, I just pull it away, probably.
Okay.
You might take pictures, though. It'd be interesting. I don't know that I've ever seen that before. So you might take pictures, and then I would pull it away.
Okay.
And just get it away.
Okay. So you think that what's on the tree is not growing on the tree, but is still growing from the ground?
Yeah. I think it's probably on the surface of the tree.
Okay.
But I doubt if it's doing anything as far as infection or anything on the tree
okay.
itself. If it's a healthy tree, and as Leslie said, if there's no, wounded areas or anything like that, it's probably just growing on the surface.
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. And I should mention the phone numbers 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL to ask a question with Leslie or Sandy about lawn and garden care and pollinators as well. The email address will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's an email we have from Sheila. Could you please tell me how you would go about growing a mimosa tree from seed? I have always wanted a mimosa tree in my yard, and the seed pods from a neighbor's tree will soon be available. I have heard you can take the seeds from the pod, keep them in a cool, dry place over the winter, and then place them in starting pots in the spring and plant them when they get about 3 inches in height. Where would be a good place to plant? We live in an area with lots of trees. Do mimosas require lots of sunlight? Do you have any specific suggestions, or is there another way to approach this?
Yeah, I think really with mimosas, I don't know that one particular, but as far as I know, if I remember correctly, it's actually a legume, so they have kind of a bean-like thing. And most of those trees actually need some kind of what they call scarification. Somehow they have an impermeable seed coat that doesn't allow water to get into the seed, so they don't germinate. So what you usually have to do is take either just a file, just a nail file or whatever, and you just want to basically just remove a little bit of the seed coat, and then you would soak it and then go ahead and plant it, because usually they need that in order to go ahead and start. So you might want to, it might be one of those things where you might just want to wait, put it in the cool spot, as you say, and then wait till spring to do that. So then you have a nice season where you can work on it. Mimosas are one of those that are a little iffy here. It was funny thing is, I was just on Route 10 in near Champaign, and I noticed a mimosa blooming, and I thought I'd never seen that tree before, and I had never seen it bloom. So you will see them around. Sometimes they kill to the ground. The roots don't die, but if we have really cold winter, they'll die to the ground, but then they'll send up new shoots and go from there. So usually see them as kind of this almost like a big shrub, because periodically they die to the ground. So they are here. They certainly like sun, probably in a little bit more if you have like a semi-protected area because of that concern of winter hardiness. It might be a good idea.
Yeah, there's one in our neighborhood near Crystal Lake Park.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We have another caller in on line one, another Chip from Philo. This is another mulch question, I believe. Good morning, Chip. You're on Focus.
Hi, Sandy. Sorry I missed the early parts of the show. You apparently had some questions about mulch. A couple of weeks ago on the show, you had a formula for a raised bed or mound that favored acidic-loving plants, blueberries, azaleas, pines, etc. And if I recall correctly, it was a pine bark mulch, pine needles, and then there was something else involved. I didn't remember what that was. And secondly, I was kind of curious where you might find the ingredients.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Perhaps that was on Mid-American Gardener, I have a feeling.
Right, yes.
So, yeah, unfortunately, I wasn't on that night, so I don't know exactly who gave the formula for that. It might be peat moss, because sometimes that is somewhat acidic as well.
They specifically said not peat moss, because it's being ground so finely that it doesn't allow air. Now, maybe with the bark and needle mulch, it's...
I think, to be honest with you, this is obviously my opinion, and I'm not sure who had talked about that other one, and there may be. So this is my opinion on – so are you doing raised beds for your blueberries and stuff, or you're just wanting
– Well, that wasn't our intention originally, but I was really intrigued by this suggestion
mm-hmm.
as a solution to constantly trying to change the acidity of the soil. soil here.
Yeah. I think usually what I recommend is this time of year, certainly into September, October, this is the time to actually prepare the blueberry bed, rhododendron bed, whatever it is that needs that acidic soil, to prepare it now, and then come next spring, it's ready to be planted.
Right.
So, and that's usually one of the things. So usually what we're looking at, things like blueberries, rhododendrons, they like a high organic matter soil. So compost, I would just get compost from wherever you get compost, or if you have your own compost, so add that, make sure there's plenty of organic matter. I would also do, ideally it'd be nice to get a soil test to find out what your pH is, and then you'd know how much sulfur to add. And really, sulfur is the thing that's really going to, it doesn't happen immediately, but it's certainly a better long-term solution, and it is one of those that's going to, it's really tough to change the pH of soil. That's why we have these problems. And unfortunately, things like pine needles and stuff, although they're somewhat acidic, they don't change the pH very darn fast. So you're better off doing, if you're going to prepare a bed, I would use sulfur. If you have the soil test, you can actually find out just how much sulfur you need to add for the planting area that you're doing. So I would do that now, and then it has plenty of time to sort of help to change the pH by the time spring rolls around, and then you can go ahead and plant. Pine needles are good. You know, they're a nice mulch. You certainly can. And anybody who has white pines, I guarantee it has pine needle mulch. So just go around town. Anybody with pine, with white pines, because they drop their needles all the time in the fall, and so usually plenty of needles for that. And you could use, certainly use that as the mulch. But I think for a better, my opinion, for a better long-term solution and lowering the pH, you're better off using compost and sulfur.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, and let's go straight to another caller we have in on line three, Sally from Champaign. A question, I believe, about spinach.
Yes, this is for Sandy, and a few years ago you had an article in the paper about late summer, early fall planting, and you recommended that you put the spinach seed in the refrigerator for 2 weeks, and I was wondering why, and is the same true for lettuce?
No, it is one of those things that sometimes if it's really hot, spinach is kind of a, you know, once it gets going, it's really a tough plant and it, you know, grows really well. But sometimes it's really hard to get them to germinate, especially in the fall, because it's so, fall meaning now, meaning late summer, because it's so hot. So it's sort of just to encourage them to germinate quickly so you don't have to worry quite so much about keeping them moist, because that's the biggest complaint I hear about spinach is that people can't get the seeds to germinate. So that was one thing. Lettuce, I wouldn't worry about at all. It germinates really quickly, and generally you have really good luck this time of year to go ahead and put out lettuce for a late season crop. Works out really well. So lettuce, I wouldn't worry too much about. So the leafies are a great thing to add this time of year, and you can, and they don't mind, you know, if we get a little cool spell in October or whatever it is, you know, you can really plant leafies really late in the season.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. We have a question coming in for Leslie. This is Karen from Tinsfield, if I have the name right. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
I have planted a lot of a few acres of CRP with pollinator enhancement. And in the past, we just planted it 3 years ago. In the past 2 years, I've seen an unbelievable increase in the number of butterflies over this area, which is about 3 acres. And this year, it's like they're gone. And I spoke with another person. They're just not there. And I spoke with another person who lives about 5 miles from here who has an area of prairie, and he also photographs butterflies and pollinators, and we're just trying to figure out where are they.
This is what I'm hearing from everybody that's been stopping at the pollinatorium. The butterflies are just down this year, and some people are attributing it to the cold, wet spring we've had. Some people think it goes back as far as the drought last year affecting them, and then the populations weren't built up. So yes, the butterfly populations are down in general this year.
Can we hope that they'll rebound?
Well, there's good nectar sources at the moment. This is a good year, even a little more even for the rain. So, yeah, I'm hoping they rebound next year.
Okay. Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'm wondering, are you seeing that same problem with bees as well? What's their population level at this point?
Well, see, I normally watch honeybees, so our bees in this area that I've seen so far are doing well. They had a late start, But they're doing fine at the moment.
They're affected by weather factors maybe differently than butterflies?
Yes. And honeybees, since they're a colony people raise, the beekeepers tend to feed them when it's droughty. But there isn't extra food put out for the butterflies normally.
Okay. Very interesting. Well, it's time for a short break, and we'll be back with more lawn, gardening, and pollinator advice from Sandy Mason and Leslie Deem. This is Focus on WILL.
People are living under the illusion that the American dream is working for them. And it's rigged by the guys at the tippy top.
Laura Dern played a naive whistleblower on the HBO series Enlightened. The second and final season is coming out on DVD. On The Next Fresh Air, the series creator and co-star Mike White, join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from WGLT in Bloomington, presenting their final recycled music sale, Friday and Saturday, August 16th and 17th, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., and Sunday, August 18th, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., at the Crossroads Center, Wiley Drive in Normal. More information is at WGLT.org.
We're back on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, here with horticulture expert Sandy Mason of the University of Illinois Extension and entomologist Leslie Deem, director of the U of I Pollinatarium. And we're ready to take your questions on lawn and garden care, plus the insects that pollinate them. The phone numbers, 333-9455, 333-WILL. The toll-free number, if you're calling from outside the 217 area code, 800-222-9455. Again, 800-222-WILL. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Patient caller on line two, James from Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Oh, hi. Yeah, all my impatiens are dying, and I looked it up on the Internet. It says it's like this new strain of downy mildew, and that once you have it, there's nothing you can do about it, and you can't plant impatiens the next year because it'll persist. But yeah, I've been wondering if you've been seeing this occur, and should I just give up on growing impatiens next year?
So you're in Urbana?
Yeah.
You said? I'm not aware of it here. It seemed to be showing up quite a bit in the Chicago area. And you looked at the symptoms, and because there's certainly other reasons why impatiens will die. Where did you get the plants?
I got them locally. It's from several sources. But, I mean, it just started happening like a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, you might, you know,
I looked it up on the Internet, and I mean, it has the exact. It's sort of like you look at the underneath of the leaf, and it's sort of like a fuzzy white stuff under there.
Yeah, I would, to be honest with you, I'd really be interested in that because I haven't seen it locally. So I don't know if you'd be willing to either bring a sample into our office. We're at 801 North Country Fair Drive. Or, take a sample to the plant clinic so we can get an identification for sure that that's what it is. Because that would really be good information. Because, as I said, I don't know of it locally.
Okay. Yeah, I've never seen it before. And, yeah, I've always grown impatience. But, it's some new thing. I guess it started on the East Coast or something. I don't know. But
yeah, it's downy mildew. Yeah, it's downy mildew of impatience, and it does seem to be one of those things that's quite serious because it actually can hang out in the soil. And you kind of alluded to that the recommendation is not to replant impatiens in those same areas.
Yeah, right.
Are your plants in the ground or in pots?
Oh well, I have most of them are in the ground, and then I have some in pots. Some in this one pot. The ones in the pot look okay. It's just the ones in the ground are all dying.
Because there certainly are other diseases that could affect impatiens. So
yeah.
That's why I think it's important to make sure that we really, know
okay.
what
well,
it
I
is.
Well, I could try to get a sample in.
Yeah, if you could just put it in a plastic bag, something.
Like
that,
I live in East Urbana, so yeah. It's like quite a drive over there.
Where's the plant clinic at?
The plant clinic is actually in Turner Hall, the fourth floor of Turner Hall, which is just right off of Dorner Drive. It's certainly closer to Urbana, if you'd be willing to do that. It'd be a really important thing to know, to be honest with you, because if it's some other disease, then it may not be an issue for you as far as replanting and patients there.
Yeah.
There is a charge for the plant clinic, so I will tell you that. But it would be it really is one of those diseases that it's important to know if that's really what it is.
Yeah.
So okay. I'd encourage you to do that.
Yeah, I may or may not be able to sample over. If I'm in that neighborhood, I'll try to remember to bring a sample.
Yeah.
How much do they charge?
I think it's $15 for a sample.
Okay.
But then you'd know whether you can replant or not and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Okay. Right. Okay. Thanks. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for calling in.
Okay. Bye.
Take care. And I'm just looking up the University of Illinois Plant Clinic now with the extension. If you want to look up their website, it's web.extension.illinois.edu/plant clinic. And do they keep any sort of regular hours? What's a good time to get over there if you?
I think it's the usual Monday through Friday. I think they're closed over the lunch hour. I think they close at 4:30, so 8:30. I would just check their website to make sure about the hours.
That's right. And if you Google University of Illinois Plant Clinic, it will come.
It'll pop up.
It'll come right up. And there are a lot of details on this website.
Yeah. Actually, there's a lot of great info on the website itself. And I'm sure there's probably something there on downy mildew of impatiens. There's also a new disease on downy mildew of basil, which we're really worried about, too. Because both of those are serious diseases because they can hang out in the soil. And they can be problems even in compost piles and stuff. So it really, spreads far and wide if this is what this might be that he has.
I wanted to ask a question. Leslie Deem, talking about pollinators, we've been talking about bees and about butterflies. Hummingbirds, do you work with any of those at the pollinatarium?
Some of them flit around our shoulders and that when we're working.
Now, I have a friend lives up in the suburbs, and she has a hummingbird feeder, which is essentially sugar water on a little on a little device outside. But if you would like to have hummingbirds in your garden pollinating your plants, well, what do they like?
They tend to like flowers that are more red, and they tend to like to have a long, more tubular flower. So one I can think of right now is trumpet vine. A native one I'm thinking of is, if you have a wetter spot, cardinal flower. And Sandy, do you have other?
Yeah, I'm actually kind of surprised sometimes that some of the flowers I see them. And, early in the spring, they love columbine. So if you have columbine, that seems to be one of the favorite ones. I've even seen them on my butterfly bush. They'll actually feed on the small flowers of butterfly bush. And also even hostas, some of the tubular flowers of hostas.
And some of the salvias.
The salvia, yeah, they like a lot of the salvias, even the blue ones. So it is, you'd be surprised sometimes, but I think that whole idea of that sort of tubular type of flower, even if it's a small one, I think is a really good one for the hummingbirds. And I think, don't a lot of the butterflies like the same kind of flowers? So,
butterflies also interested in the tubular flowers or also in the red?
They're going more for the nectar than the red. Usually hummingbirds can see the red. Bees do not see red. So if you see bees at red flowers, they're going for the nectar, and because it has like a high ultraviolet coloring, then they can
see. That's right. We're talking about creatures, certainly with the bees, but maybe can the butterflies also see some colors that we do not see?
They also see in the ultraviolet we don't see.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because you don't know what to put out there for ultraviolet.
No, most of us don't have a special camera to see the nectar guides that they can see.
I don't know if you bring a black light out to your plants at night, that would give some idea.
Well, there's night blooming plants that are usually more white and usually go more for fragrance for things that are hummingbird or bat pollinator tend to be white flowers.
You said bat pollinator?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's something I was wondering about, that bats do some pollination. Do they do that here in Illinois?
Not that I know of. The bats I'm thinking of usually go to the saguaro cactuses in the southwest.
Okay, so not going to bring any of those around here.
No, very cool, but I'm not going to see those.
Are there any other insects that pollinate besides bees and butterflies?
Yes, other insects can do it. It's just that bees are much more efficient than other insects. But like beetles can bumble into flower. Flies can go to flowers and carry pollen. They just have to carry the pollen between two flowers of the same kind for the pollination to be able to help lead to making seeds.
But it sounds like if you're trying to attract an insect, the most efficient ones are going to be bees and butterflies.
Yes. So people tend to like the butterflies for their beauty and their fluttering. Bees are much more directed in their flight.
Okay. And you have to be a little more respectful of them, I guess.
You have to let them do their thing and yeah.
Besides we're talking about types of flowers, colors of flowers, is there any particular way that you might group or plant or arrange them that will attract pollinators?
I would tend to do them in swaths and bigger clumps than just individual plants, because then once like a honeybee finds a flower source, they can go back to the hive, give the little waggle dance, and tell their sisters where to go find the food source. So if there's more quantity, it's easier for them to gather what they need and feed the colony.
I was looking on the Pollinatarium website, and I came across a program called Bee Spotter, which is apparently something where you're inviting the public to help gather data on the bee population, and really the wild bee population, not the bees that people are keeping. Can you tell me more about that?
Right. So this is a citizen science project. And when honeybees got in trouble a while ago and colony collapse disorder was noted, we knew the honeybees were in trouble, but we also wondered about the native bees. Honeybees are not native to here, but bumblebees are.
Okay, and when we're talking about the collapse disorder, is that something that's happening here in central Illinois?
They have different difficulties all around. It's not an easily defined thing. So we have bee losses here, and so they're looking at the different diseases and things that will cause bee loss in different places.
And does the Bee Spotter program help in just trying to figure out what's going on?
The Bee Spotter program is trying to figure out what bumblebee species we have here right now. And if we know more of what numbers there are, then if there is a decline, we can track it better. So this is trying to get a handle on what bee species we do have in Illinois right now.
How does that work? How do you go about spotting bees for the Bee Spotter program?
So you take a digital picture. And usually if you can take like a side shot and a back shot, it helps if you can have more than one image of the same bee. And then you sign on to Bee Spotter and you can upload the image. And then there's an entomologist on the other end, Terry Harrison, who will identify the bee. And sometimes they can get it down to species. And sometimes the pictures are just a little fuzzy and you can't quite get there.
Okay, but it's not like you're trying to count every bee, but you're just trying to get an idea of what sort of species are out there.
What species are out there. Mm-hmm.
So maybe folks would just take pictures of the bees they see and maybe bees that are doing some pollination that are not obviously honeybees. I don't know. Is it sometimes a...
They can send in honeybee shots.
Sometimes, do they look alike, a lot of bee species? First glance?
At first glance, a lot of the bumblebees look alike, but if you count the stripes and the colorings, you can determine a lot of times what species it is. But at first glance, it looks like a bumblebee.
Okay. So, bumblebees look different from honeybees generally?
Bumblebees are bigger generally, yeah.
Okay. And so if you go over to the website for the Pollinatarium, or maybe if you just Google Bee Spotter.
Google Bee Spotter. There also is a link to it from the Pollinatarium website.
Now, is this a national program, or is this something that the Pollinatarium has been doing?
This is something Bee Spotter actually started before the Pollinatarium. So this is something that is done just for Illinois at the moment.
Okay. How helpful has this program been?
Oh, it's been very helpful. They found some bees that they didn't think were in Illinois anymore.
Okay, well that's good to keep up on. So something that's just a click away. If you Google Bee Spotter and the Pollinatarium, you can find out more about being involved in that program.
Yeah, the more eyes, the more we'll see.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and there's still time for your questions about garden and lawn care for Sandy Mason of the University of Illinois Extension, and questions about pollinators for Leslie Deem of the U of I Pollinatarium. The phone number's 333-9455 are 1-800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Sandy Mason, I was wondering, I was looking at a column, I believe, of yours from a week or so back saying that, no, it's not too late in August to get your vegetables in. And it's a week later now. Is it too late yet?
It's not too late.
You can have something that you can harvest and eat before the frost.
Absolutely, because there actually are quite a few plants that will tolerate light frost. They're fine with it. So a lot of the leafies we talked about a little bit before, but even a lot of the root crops, things like carrots and parsnips and beets and a lot of those, they'll actually even get a little sweeter once they've gone through a little bit of a frost and it gets cool. So basically you're planting them thinking that, you know, you're going to go ahead and harvest them, you know, well before, you know, it gets super cold, but certainly well into, you know, October, November, you can still have vegetables. So it's not that you have to give up, because I know how busy it is in the springtime for a lot of folks. It's just, you know, you just don't get around to it. And you always think you're going to do this or that, and you still have a packet of seeds. Well, it's not too late to plant them. It's going to be too late for things like squash, you know, pumpkins, those kinds of things. It ends up being a little bit too late for them. But what you need to do is, if you have seeds, just read the label, see what it says, and it'll say days to harvest. And so that you can count back. You know, usually our first frost, our average date of first frost is generally we're looking at mid-October. It certainly can frost before that, but sort of the average date is sort of mid-October. So it's not too late for a lot of things. So, and you don't need much space when you think about things like radishes and carrots and stuff like that. It doesn't take a lot of space to go ahead and plant a few of those.
So we're saying you got about 60, 70 days left. And so you can grow things like that.
Oh, absolutely. And because a lot of the plants, especially things like the, you know, lettuce and stuff like that, we're not waiting for it to flower and fruit and all that kind of stuff like we would do with squash or tomatoes or anything. We're really eating the leaves or whatever it is, or the roots of the particular plant. So you're not waiting for them to flower and all that kind of stuff. So it certainly can be done. You could even plant, if you can find transplants, we're a little late to do it from seed, but if you could find transplants of things like broccoli and some of those actually do quite well as a fall crop as well.
Well, that's good to know. There is still hope.
There's still hope.
Let's go to line one. Egesty, if I have the name right, a question about a blackworm. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi. Actually, it's Agastya. It's my son, and he wants to ask the question to Leslie. Just a minute. He's a six-year-old boy, so you might have to pay attention to what he's saying a little more careful.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Leslie.
Hello.
So, we got this bagworm pupa from the Japanese tea garden.
You got a caterpillar from the Japanese tea garden?
I think it's a black worm.
Oh, you think you have a black worm?
Like a black caterpillar? Nope, did we lose him?
Augustia, are you still there?
Oh, maybe we lost him.
Well, you see one of these things. What can you tell us about it if we're talking about a black worm?
Well, they can bring it to the pollinatarium, and we can try to identify it. And if he would like to rear it up, we can try to figure out what food plant it needs so that he can rear it out.
What does a black worm become?
Actually,
could be a swallowtail. They're kind of black, but they have yellow on them, too. I wonder if he's seen like a...
It could be a cutworm.
Could be a cutworm. If it's all black, for the most part, mm-hmm. It could be cutworm. But even aren't the swallowtails, aren't they pretty black when they're, especially when they're really young? Aren't
yeah.
they pretty black?
Yeah.
They have some yellow on them. So there's several things, isn't there?
Yeah, there's several things it could be. So okay. We can try to figure out what host plant it is.
So if you bring them over to the pollinatarium, should we come during the weekend hours if you want to bring it over? Or what's a good time?
You can come during the weekend hours or just send me an email and I'll meet them there and... we have a few rearing cages, although we did have a caterpillar chew out of one.
Oh, no.
So we need to get a little tougher rearing cage for the caterpillars.
That's a tough caterpillar.
my gosh, yes. I don't know what you're building those cages out of. Anyway, and by the way, we do have links to the pollinatarium as well as the extension to our website now. If you go to will.illinois.edu/focus and look for the listing on this program. We have a caller on line 3, Dave from Atwood. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi. This time of year, my butterfly bushes start get kind of looking leggy. Is it too late to really do a severe prune back on them and hope I get the bigger blooms come back?
Yeah, I think I wouldn't do a severe prune at this point because I don't know that they would have enough time to continue to flower if you
just
want them to continue to flower.
Just keep deadheading them?
Yeah, I would go ahead and deadhead them for now. And what you might, I don't know if you typically have cut them back in the springtime. I'd really cut them back hard in the springtime. They can take
I
a hard prune.
But I can't emphasize to people enough not to prune them back at all in the wintertime. To wait till spring
right.
to prune them back.
Right, right.
Kills them a lot of time.
Yeah,
I had a comment, too, on the butterflies. I've got some conservation acreage, and I also have butterfly gardens, and I've watched the decline, too. Mm-hmm. Seems to me it coincides with these systemics that they're using in the corn and soybeans to kill bugs. Doesn't that make sense?
Well, but I'd also say that, you know, with the drought last year, if you think there's fewer plants
yeah.
for them to eat, the drought certainly affects insects.
Some of the butterflies even do better in drought years, though. I've just seen it ever in the last 4 years since they've really introduced these full-fledged. I've just watched insect populations in general, it seems like, going down. If all it takes is a bite for it to kill them, I don't know.
I haven't read a lot of studies on that, so I can't speak on that one at the moment.
Okay, well, something to think about.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you very much, Dave. And we have another caller on line two. I think this is Eileen from Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. My question is for Leslie about my butterfly bush that was blooming beautifully, and then after one of the great heat waves we had, it lost all its flowers, and it hasn't flowered again. I have watered it, though.
Yeah, mine went crispy after one of the heat waves, and I deadheaded it and a little harder than I normally would. I cut it back just a little more, and I'm now getting new buds and new flowers, but it took a little while.
Okay, so you have to deadhead it with a pruning shears?
I use I happened to have scissors when I was walking by it. So my bush was young enough that scissors were enough. But, yeah, it's an older bush. You might need the pruning shears.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. And for the uninitiated, a butterfly bush, does it attract butterflies or does it look like, do its flowers look like butterflies?
It's a nectar plant, so it feeds the butterflies. And a nice range of colors, so whites and purples, and there's some that are even mixed colors, mm-hmm. Pinks.
And so if you want butterflies, that's a good thing to grow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, are they hard to grow? Do they take time to get up and get mature? Or how do they work out?
They grow really tall in a year. Some of them are much more winter hardy than others. Some of them die back all the way to the ground. And then, like Sandy said, in the spring you give them a prune and let them re-sprout.
Okay, and you were talking about deadheading. Went crispy. I never heard that term before. I like
Sorry.
That one.
That's a scientific term.
But deadheading, what does that involve?
Removing the dead blossoms and dead flowers.
Okay, so just getting them out so that maybe something new can come up mm-hmm. in their place. Sandy, I had a question. A little bit of quiet here. I had a question about radishes, and it was about a question that you answered mm-hmm. in your newspaper column, where someone was complaining that their radishes were too hot, mm-hmm. and they want to know what caused that. My complaint with store-bought radishes had always been that they were too mild, mm-hmm. and I didn't know why, but you gave the answer as being it depends on how long you grow them.
Mm-hmm. It really is a maturity thing, and probably in stores, typically people don't want them too hot. So you're one of the folks that actually likes them hot, and there are people that like them hot. So you'd be a really good candidate to actually grow your own because then you can leave them out in the garden. So the longer you leave them in the garden, the hotter they get. So it's really a maturity thing. So if you like them mild, then you pick them, or harvest the root fairly quickly. And you just radishes are really quick. They're probably one of our quickest crops. So I think a lot of times people just don't realize they're ready to go ahead and be picked, and they just leave them out there. And then when they do finally harvest them, then they're these super hot things.
Okay, so that's really, it's not a matter of breeding the radish. I thought maybe somebody.
It's really a maturity thing.
I thought maybe someone was breeding some super hot radishes.
Some super hot. There probably
go with
are.
Go with their hot peppers.
Yeah, there you go. I'm not going to say that there aren't people out there doing that, but for most folks, folks. This is what's happening.
Okay, so it's just a matter of how long.
How long you leave them in the garden.
So as soon as they look good, you can pick them? Or...
Yeah, certainly the big thing with any of these root crops is that you have to thin them. People usually plant them way too thick, and if they're planted too thick, then you don't get the root to form. So you have to make sure that they're thin properly. But then once they get to a decent size, depending on what variety it is, then you'd go ahead and dig them and pull them up, actually.
Okay, and we have time for another caller on line 4, Sam from Oak Forest. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. I'm very fortunate to have a professional. I've got crooked yellow neck squash growing. The leaves are very broad and large. It's flowered, but the fruit, I've only had one squash, and I see many flowers. I'm getting some kind of a white... residue on the flowers and on the stems, I think. And I was wondering, is there a disease or anything that's keeping the fruit from growing, the squash? Mm-hmm.
So does it seem like once they get this white stuff or whatever on the flowers, do they quickly die? Like they brown and die?
The flowers, I see like a couple of flowers. And the rest of them are kind of like wilting, and the leaves are very broad and very healthy looking, and except for that white residue on there.
Yeah, because usually it'll start showing up on the leaves, so they certainly get a number of diseases. So I guess I'd wonder about a couple things, because they have male and female flowers, and you can tell the female flowers because it's still, even though they haven't been pollinated yet, it's still kind of swollen right underneath the flower. So the ones that are kind of swollen underneath the flower, those are the female flowers, and that's where the fruit's going to form. The other ones are male flowers. If they don't have that swollen area, they're male flowers, and they serve as the pollen, but you won't have any fruit on those. And a lot of times early in the season, as they're first growing, you get lots and lots of male flowers, and then the female flowers finally come around. So I would start looking, make sure you have female flowers. You can act like a bee and do your own pollination with the male flower, the female flower. You could
get yourself some Q-tips.
Q-tips.
With my finger?
Yeah, probably Q-tips would be a bar, and then you can make sure you can get plenty of pollen. Or sometimes I've just taken the whole flower off, the male flower off, and basically just moved it around from female flower to female flower. So it could be a pollination issue, just what we've been talking about in the way of if there's been plenty of pollinators out there. I don't know if you've seen bees or anything that would have helped to pollinate them, because that certainly is one of the reasons why you might not get your squash.
Okay, I thank you very, very much.
Mm-hmm. Sam, thank you very much, and we are out of time on Focus. We have one other caller, and maybe, Sandy, you could take that caller off
sure,
the air if you have
to.
A little more time. But Sandy Mason with the U of I Extension and Leslie Deem of the U of I Pollinatarium, thanks to the both of you for
thank
being
you.
On the program
thank
today.
You.
Go to our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. Look up this day's program to find links to the Extension and the Pollinatarium websites. Welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program at will.illinois.edu/focus. Monday on Focus, an encore broadcast of our program about Joe Cannon, Republican Speaker of the House from Danville in the early 20th century. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WYLL.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit of Illinois, offering financial products and services specifically for the agriculture industry, including farm real estate and operating loans, crop insurance, and point-of-sale financing, as well as farm cash management solutions.
I'm Todd Gleason. This is Illinois Public Media. Let's check the numbers as they're trading in Chicago on this Friday morning. September corn futures are down 5.5 cents at this hour. $4.68 the last tick. December there at 4.53¾, down 6 cents. And the March contract at 4.67, 6¼ lower. May corn futures 4.75¼, down 6¼. And July at 4.81½, down 5¾. December contract 6 lower at 4.89¾. August beans at 13.50. $5.50 and a quarter, 5.5 lower. November down 3 at $11.81 and a quarter. January beans at $11.86 and three quarters, 2.5 lower, and July at $11.97 are unchanged. Bean meal futures down $8. Bean oil 2 cents higher. Live cattle futures down 40 in the October at $126.67 and a half. September feeders at $157.62 and a half. They're down 20 cents, and lean hogs at $84.92 and a half are 32.5 cents lower. September wheat futures at $6.35, down 6 and a quarter for the soft red. December down 6 at $6.47 and three quarters, and hard red December at $7.03 and three quarters, down 3 cents on the morning. The outside market show us crude oil trading at $105.43 a barrel. That's up $2.03. The RBOB, or wholesale price of gasoline, at $2.88 and a half, 2 7/10 higher, and the ethanol futures at $2.14 and 8 tenths. That's down 3 2/10. Natural gas trading $3.31 and 8 tenths, up 2 1/10, and diesel fuel at $2.97 and 4 tenths, a penny and 7.5, or a penny and 7 tenths higher for the day. You're of course listening to WILL AM 580 and WILL FM 90.9 HD3 Urbanum. We're coming up on the top of the hour. It is 9 o'clock, rather 11 o'clock Central Time, noon in the Eastern Time Zone, 77 beautiful degrees outside the studios here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois.